Well, it is the Advent season. If you've never been to a Paradox's Christmas party, I encourage you to come tonight. And it's always good food and great time for fellowship. It's also a great time for debates. So if you like having a lively discussion, please come tonight. It's been a busy week. I'm not going to tell you about everything that's happened during the week, but yesterday, two major events. One, I was interviewed on a radio show by a fellow called Nick Peters. He had me on for an hour to talk about my new book, Improbable Planet. But what was interesting is he has his own nonprofit organization, and I was intrigued by how he raises money for his organization. He basically has a whole team of volunteers that makes jewelry. And then he kind of, in the middle of the interview, he said, "We're going to take a little break." And he said, "I need to talk to all of you husbands," in the sense that it's probably been your practice that you have some major offense with your wife, and you need to repair that. And if you're honest, you can look forward into the next year, and there'll probably be at least a dozen times when you're going to need to apologize and make things right. And therefore, you need to have some jewelry ready each time. So that's how he was moving his quantity of jewelry, just reminding all of us husbands about how many times we're going to need to make things right. So he's correct. I mean, that will happen. It's a prophecy that's bound to come true. So no matter what kind of husband you are. So, but I think the real highlight was what happened at Caltech. Some of you were there. Some of you were helping out at the table there. And I had done this on a lot of other campuses, and I was expecting it was going to be a faculty dinner. And there were some there, but it was mostly undergrads, graduate students, and postdoctoral research fellows. So that was kind of fun, just seeing a broad spectrum of Caltech people there. And a rich time of fellowship before I got up to speak. But the main thing is, they would have me speak as a segue to discussion around tables. They made sure that there was one Christian at each table. Each table had eight people. So there'd be one Christian at each of the tables. There's about 100 people there. But the whole idea is that the Christian would lead discussion on the various points that I brought up. And they said, "Could you please make your talk a little bit controversial?" And I said, "Well, that's not too hard for me to do." So. Make sure they had lots of fun things to talk about. And actually, they had me speak about the Ice Age cycle and global warming and how God creates our planet and all of its life for the purpose of making it possible for billions of human beings to be redeemed. So yeah, there was plenty of interesting discussions that they could drop in on that. And also, they had me wander around, and basically when the person who was moderating discussion got stuck, they'd have me come in and field some questions, but I would leave as soon as they were able to keep the discussion going, go into another table. What was interesting was at one table, I met this young man, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No." He says, "Well, I met you 8 years ago, and we had a conversation." I said, "Well, how long was the conversation?" He says, "A little bit less than 1 minute." So. I guess they expect me to be able to remember everybody I meet, but so. But it was up in Vancouver, and I was speaking there to a group of people. It was mainly atheists and some theologians. But he said, "That was the night I gave my life to Jesus Christ." So, so you didn't give an invitation, but the gospel is quite clear in what you presented, and that's what I needed to hear. And the barriers I had were taken care of in what you said, so I gave my life to Christ. And I share that with you because many people you will bring to faith in Jesus Christ, and they won't tell you until 15, 20, 30 years later. It's one of the advantages of living a few decades, is after you've been a Christian for a few decades, people will come up to you and say, "I met you 26 years ago, and what you said made the difference. And that was a turning point in my giving my life to Christ." So for those of you who are relatively new in the Christian faith, hang in there. It will happen. People, I think that's going to be the joy of being up in heaven, is we're going to see all the connections. fact, one of the books I'm working on right now is basically telling the story of Christians I met very fleetingly that actually had an impact in my giving my life to Christ. For example, I can remember being in downtown Vancouver. My parents were taking all of us kids to a department store. And there was a guy preaching on the street right by the curb, and he had a crowd of about a dozen people around him. I heard maybe 15 seconds worth because my parents quickly rushed me away. But what he said in those 15 seconds is something I remembered. And even my own father, he only quoted one scripture verse to me in his entire life, and he didn't even know it was from the Bible. But I told him when he was in his 70s, I says, "Dad, you said something to me when I was about 11 years of age, and it's something I could never forget." He says, "You quoted a verse from Proverbs." He said, "I did." And so I gave him the passage, "There is a way which seems right to a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death." And he says, "I didn't know that was from the Bible. I thought it was from Shakespeare or whatever." But when he quoted that, I began to think about that. You know, maybe what I'm actually committing my life to isn't really what I should be committing my life to. And so, you know, just realizing little snippets can make a huge difference in a person's life. So, but also what was fun was during the dinner time at Caltech there, there was this group of geophysicists. And you know what I love about Caltech, the reason why I chose to go to Caltech after I got my PhD, I knew it was highly egalitarian. It's a research facility where the undergrads, the graduate students, the support staff, the postdoctoral fellows, and the senior professors are all treated as equals. You know, you'll have Nobel laureates teaching classes, but they said, "We know these undergrads are going to be the future Nobel laureates." So they literally treat everybody as equals. And that was very much evident last night. There was this whole table full of geophysicists, but they're all at different educational levels. But what was interesting is they said, "Is this thing dark energy real?" And I said, "Yes, it is." I said, "Is it going to make the universe expand faster and faster as time goes on?" I said, "Yes, it will." And says, "Well, how fast is it expanding right now?" I could tell they were really worried. And I said, "Well, the farthest reaches of the cosmos that we can see, the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event, 13.8 billion light years away, says it's already moving relative to us at just a hair under the velocity of light." So they quickly picked up on that and said, "Well, does that mean that relatively soon we're not going to be able to see that radiation?" I said, "Yes." They said, "Well, does it also mean that as time goes on, we're not going to be able to see distant galaxies?" I said, "Yes, that's right. We're going to be seeing less and less of the universe." And they said, "Well, how does that make you as an astronomer feel?" I said, "Well, it makes us feel really depressed that, you know, what's been thrilling about the discipline of astronomy is that we've been seeing more and more of the universe. And I'm old enough to remember that when our view of the universe was only 1/1,000,000th of what it is today, where we can now see literally all the way back to the beginning of time. But as we move into the future, we will be seeing less and less." But what's interesting, they said, "Well, how bad is it going to get?" I said, "Well, interesting. I just wrote an article on that. That's in my blog. I think it just got posted on Thursday about the consequences of a universe that continues to expand faster and faster." I said, "What will happen is that the universe will expand faster than the velocity of light, and then will begin to expand many times faster than the velocity of light. And it'll expand at such a rapid rate, there'll come a time when our Milky Way galaxy will be torn apart. Why? Because one edge of our galaxy compared to the other edge of the galaxy will be moving away from one another at greater than the velocity of light. And when that happens, our Milky Way galaxy gets torn apart and destroyed." They said, "Well, what happens after that?" I says, "Well, there'll come a time when the same thing will happen to our solar system, where we're gonna have Neptune relative to Mercury separating from one another at greater than the velocity of light. And when that happens, our solar system gets destroyed." And they said, well, what happens after that?
You won't
care. I said, well, there'll come a time when one edge of planet Earth relative to the opposite edge will be separating from one another greater than the velocity of light. So, well, what's that going to do? I said, well, it'll destroy the Earth. And I said, is there anything more damaging that's going to take place after that? And he says, oh, yeah, that's only the beginning. So eventually, the universe expands so fast that molecules get torn apart, that the electrons orbiting the atom, one electron relative to another one, will be moving apart from one another at greater than the velocity of light. And the molecules get destroyed. And said, it'll even happen to the nucleus of the atom, where the protons and neutrons relative to one another will be separating from one another greater than the velocity of light. All the nuclei get destroyed. Then the fundamental particles get destroyed. They said, well, how much worse can it get? And I said, this is how bad it can get. Eventually, the universe will expand so fast that space and time get obliterated. And then the universe ceases to exist. And I said, well, when's all this going to happen? And I said, well, we astronomers are actually measuring something called the Omega parameter, which is basically a measure of how rapidly the universe will accelerate on into the future. And it says, the good news is, if the omega factor exactly equals minus 1.0, it's going to take infinite time before space gets torn apart. And so, well, what about our galaxy? Well, I said, that'll happen, but it'll be a while. But I said, if it's only minus 1.5, if that's the value of the omega factor, then space and time get torn apart in only 22 billion years. So, not a lot of time when you consider the universe is 14 billion years old. 22 billion years from now, that could happen. But here's the good news. We are measuring this omega factor. The best measurement we have so far is that it's about minus 1.02 plus or minus 0.03. So it may be exactly minus 1.0, which case is going to take infinite time. And if it's less than minus 1.0, and then the error bars say it's even possible that it could be, then it won't happen. But the greater or the less it is compared to minus 1.0, the faster that thing will happen. They call it the big rip. So you can Google that, or you can get my blog article all about the big rip. And why you should give a rip about the big rip, okay? Yes.
So then we know for sure that matter can go faster than the speed of light. We know that.
Well, dark energy, okay, everything in physics is constrained to the velocity of light except the expansion of the space surface of the universe. And the universe is about two-thirds dark energy. It's the dominant component of the universe. But the way dark energy works, as the space surface of the universe expands, dark energy becomes progressively more powerful in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. And it's been accelerating now for about 7 billion years.
But it obliterates matter eventually?
Eventually, if the omega factor is less than minus 1.0, it will eventually destroy the universe and even destroy space and time itself. Well, if it's exactly minus 1.0, it takes infinite time to get there, okay? But if it's a little bit less than minus 1.0, it will happen in finite time. So yeah, I mean, that's really the theme for the ultimate disaster movie. So Hollywood will probably pick up on this shortly. Yes? Well, infinity just means that it's an unimaginably large number.
So it's not that it'll never happen.
It's probably going to have no impact on your investment portfolio.
No, I'm just saying that we know that nothing is infinite, that the universe is not infinite. And if there's nothing that can be forever.
Well, given that it's going to take infinite time for that to happen, if the value is exactly minus 1.0, then yeah. There's no way you're going to see it happen.
Right, we're not going to see it happen, but right. It doesn't mean that it's not that it's going on for infinity.
It is
going
to happen.
Well, if the value is minus 1.0, yeah, there will be certain consequences to the expansion of the universe, but it's not going to lead to the disruption of molecules, atoms, and space and time. Okay, so, but, and so far we can see everything, but I said, you know, here's the good news in all this. If God had placed his human beings any earlier in the history of the universe than right now, light from the cosmic creation event wouldn't have time to travel on the space surface of our universe and reach our telescopes. So if God created us any earlier, we would not be able to see the cosmic creation event. But it's also true if God created us any later, we wouldn't be able to see it. Because if he created us any later, dark energy would be expanding that light from the cosmic creation event away from us at greater than the velocity of light, which means it'd be impossible to reach our telescope. What does that mean? God put us here at the one time where we could read 100% of the history of the universe. And it's our ability to read 100% of the history of the universe where we actually can directly witness God creating the universe. Because that's the power of astronomy. We have direct access to the past. We have no access to the present. We have direct access to the past because of the velocity of light. But God put us here at a time where we could actually see 100% of the history of the universe. And that's because I believe, just like God wanted us to read all 66 books of the Bible, he wanted us to be able to read the entirety of the book of nature. Yes?
Yeah, just to kind of clarify some of these numbers, in my mind, maybe other people, that if the omega factor was minus one exactly, then all these other rip-apart events would happen in a finite, calculable amount of time from now. Is that right?
Yes, but the ultimate rip would not happen until infinite time.
Right.
Would not ever happen, correct. Yeah. So, yes.
Plus and minus, how much time are we talking about that we...
Well, given the error bars...
You can see the whole universe. How long has that existed in the past and in the future?
Okay. Well, what you'll see in my blog article is that the error bars on the geometry of the universe are such we astronomers cannot give you an exact date as to when we'll no longer be able to see the cosmic creation event. It could be just thousands of years away. It could be millions of years away. It's certainly not a billion years away. It's much less than a billion. So, and you know, give us some more time, we'll give you a more accurate date as to when things are going to get depressing for astronomers.
Same thing in the past. Then.
Same thing in the past, correct. So that's kind of where we are in our measurements right now. But your tax dollars are being wisely spent to try to measure the omega factor with a lot more precision. In fact, that paper just got published this week where they said we now have it measured to 3% precision. And there's a program already underway that'll get that down to 2% precision, and then they want more of your taxpayer dollars to get it down to about 0.1% precision. I'm in favor of spending your tax dollars to make that happen, so. And it's not much money. In the back, and then we'll come back to you. Yeah.
But isn't this whole discussion academic? Doesn't God have other plans?
Yes. Yeah. That was my message last night at Caltech, is that, you know, forget about the omega factor. The ice age cycle is operating in such a way that rather quickly we're no longer going to have extreme climate stability. And we're not talking billions of years, we're talking hundreds of years. So, and you know, we're all concerned about global warming and climate stability. There are things we humans can do to extend the period of climate stability, but there's a limit. The cycles in the orbit of the Earth guarantee no matter what we do as human beings, we're going to enter a time of extreme climate instability in less than a maximum of 1,400 years, and it could happen as briefly as, say, 50 or 60 years. So, in fact, there's some evidence, one paper has already been published, that we may be actually seeing the first sign of the start of the next ice age. And what I showed last night at Caltech, if you look at the entire period when we've had an ice age cycle, the climate has been changing by plus or minus 24 degrees Fahrenheit over timescales of just a few centuries, which basically makes it impossible to be able to grow food to feed billions of human beings. They said, well, how many people could we feed? I said, a few million. You're not going to be able to feed a billion people. if you got that kind of extreme climate instability. So, now, you were there. I think I also saw Linda. You were there as well. You had a question, so I'm going to, yeah. But what I want to do is I want these people to give a report. Go ahead. Okay. Go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, so while all this is happening, this expansion and this universe expanding and everything, billions of years from now, so where is the new creation? How does it come to me? Is it going to be from another dimension while all this is happening?
Well, the promise of Romans 8:23 is that once the full number of human beings that God intends to redeem are in fact redeemed, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. God created this universe to be a theater for the redemption of billions of human beings. So once that has been accomplished, and once evil has been conquered and permanently eliminated, the universe no longer has a place. And God will speak it out of existence. As he spoke it out of existence, he'll speak it out of existence and replace it with a brand new realm. And it'll be a realm with radically different physics and radically different dimensions. As I was sharing with people last night who were believers, we had a lot of unbelievers there, but we had some believers as well. I said, you know, one of the frustrations of being a Christian is we have this really strong desire to spend fellowship with fellow believers. But you can't spend fellowship with all the believers you want to because we're constrained by linear time. I've got friends in South Africa that I hardly ever see or talk to. You know, you can get on the phone, but there's a limit. And I know friends in Germany I'd like to spend time with, but you just can't do it. In the new creation, we'll no longer be constrained to linear time. We'll no longer have to worry about trying to sustain our bodies because nothing will decay. There'll be no decay. And so we're going to be liberated into a relationship potential that's impossible in this creation. And the geophysicist I was talking to last night were saying, well, why doesn't God give us that now? And says, because evil is yet to be conquered and the full number of human beings is yet to be redeemed. Because of gravity, because of evil, you have to have gravity and thermodynamics. If you're interested, there's a book there called Why the Universe is the Way It Is, where I explain why the laws of physics must be the way they are in order for evil to be conquered and permanently eliminated. That's why God created this universe with thermodynamics and gravity and electromagnetism and the other forces of physics. However, when evil is no longer a possibility, there is no need for gravity or thermodynamics. And so in the new creation, as it says in Revelation 21, nothing will decay, nothing will die. And it's because it's a realm where you're not going to have to worry about the second law of thermodynamics. You're not going to have to worry about gravity wearing out your body or electromagnetic radiation destroying your skin and your internal organs. That's not going to happen. You won't have to worry about cosmic rays anymore. I know that's something that's been bothering all of you a lot. But cosmic rays is really the fundamental limitation why we can't live past about 120 years. Because of the cosmic radiation we all experience, there's a hard limit on our lifespan. And you say, well, can't we get away from cosmic rays? Yes, you can, but I don't think you're going to like the environment you're going to have to live in. You'd have to go deep underground, find a mile-thick salt deposit and kind of hollow out a little place inside that salt deposit, and that will protect you from both cosmic rays and the uranium and thorium that are in the crust of the Earth. And yeah, if you have all that, you could live a lot longer. But I'm not sure you want to live a lot longer in that kind of environment. So, you got to take a lot of vegetables with you, right? And, you know, you're going to need vitamin D because there won't be any sunlight down there. So, who wants to live a life like that? So, and as I was explaining last night, there's actually a benefit to the fact that we don't live a long time. Because we're saying, you know, why doesn't God let us live 800 or 900 years like he did before? He says, well, notice what happened. Evil run completely out of control. Short lifespans are for the benefit of the virtuous, and it keeps the unrighteous in check. So That's why it tells us in Ecclesiastes, the text that we studied last time I was here, that it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a marriage. And it's better to really think about the fact that living only 7 or 8 or 9 decades is a gift from God. And people don't think about that when they go to funerals. Basically, the time, wow, too bad that person didn't live a little longer. It's actually a good thing that we all live relatively short lifespans. After all, we have a life hereafter. It's not just this life, there's a life to come. Anyway, you were helping at the book table, John and Gloria. I was wondering if you'd like to give a, because I just saw a lot of activity at that table. And this is really unusual. I mean, these are poor college students, and they were snapping up books like I see usually professional adults snap up books. And I couldn't believe it. Some students were buying 4 and 5 books. And it's like, that's how hungry they were for the material. Did you want to say something? Because I wasn't observant to what was going on there.
Well, my probably most productive conversation was after the breakup, and people were milling around. It was with one college-age lady, and she was quite blown away by the lecture. She says, I have a lot to learn, you know. And we got talking about a number of things, and how she in the past has had maybe some difficulties with discussion of the harmony of science and scripture, you know, and I, like Genesis 1, I says, if you don't have the knowledge that there is available out there and you try to tackle it, it can be quite daunting to you, but there are really good explanations for what's happening in Genesis. And so we got into a number of issues, very productive. I love those kinds of conversations.
Well, something I saw last night that I've never seen with students is there was at least one student that was buying the DVD series on Genesis 1. You know, I don't know how much we sell that for, but I know it's not as cheap as a book.
$60.
Okay. But yeah, they were all excited about leading a group of Caltech students through this series on Genesis 1. So, very good. Yes.
Question on the window of time that we're in to see microwaves and such other things, background radiation. Using this graph up here as a temperature graph of cosmic background radiation, I'm thinking those microwaves are everywhere all the time. That the only thing that changes is not the distance away necessarily, though it may be, but the wavelength. For instance, at 10 to the negative 15th, at quark confinement, where first baryons came, protons and neutrons, it was 10.2 trillion degrees. That's now at 2.75 whatever.
Right.
So the wavelength has always been there. It's just, it's not getting away from us. It's just lengthening on the wavelength. So I don't know that the window for microwaves is necessarily cut off.
Well, what's cut off is the fact that there will come a time when that region of the, because what we're doing in these cosmic background radiation maps, that's the map you see here in the background, you're basically imaging the universe 13.8 billion light years away. And yeah, there will come a time relatively soon when that will be moving away from us at the greater than the velocity of light, and we'll no longer be able to see that. Now, you'll still be able to feel the temperature, but you won't be able to get this map.
From infinite amount of temperature, very high temperature, to 2.75 degrees. And that 2.75 may get closer to zero, but it's never going away.
Well, that's true. I could show you another graph which basically shows you the temperature of the cosmic background radiation, which is the first thing astronomers discovered back in 1964. They were able to publish that, but they didn't have the instruments to actually map the hot and cold spots on the cosmic background radiation. And so, yeah, that temperature profile is something you'll always be able to see. But in terms of the detail on the structure of the cosmic background radiation, that's where you're actually looking 13.8 billion light years away.
So we're looking that far away, but it's true, you said, and we'll always be able to see it. So we're not necessarily...
Well, what you'll be able to see is the average of all this kind of In other words, you'll be able to get the black body temperature curve. You can get that, but you're not going to get this. And it's the ability to get this that gives you all the information, well, a lot of information about the cosmic creation event.
So if it goes down to 1 degree centigrade, it seems like we should still be able to get that information.
We'll still be able to see the black body curve, but you're not going to get to see this. And see, what's happening here is these hot spots become future clusters of galaxies. And so that's one thing that astronomers have actually been able to do, is map clusters of galaxies where you're only looking away, say, 1 billion or 2 billion light years. But what they're able to demonstrate is that these galaxy clusters that are, say, 1 billion light years away correspond to individual hotspots that are 13.8 billion light years away. So they can actually look at one of these little hotspots and see how that became a future cluster of galaxies. And they can look at these blue spots and they become the voids where there are no galaxies at all. That's been one of the major achievements of astrophysics over the past decade, is to be able to take maps that are close to the present and actually correlate it with maps of the very distant past.
Yeah. Like you said, that's because of instrumentation.
Well, it takes instruments to be able to see that, but it also takes dark energy being the appropriate value. So, I mean, if you've got too much acceleration of the universe, then all this stuff that you see here is moving relative to us at greater than the velocity of light, which means you won't be able to see it. So, okay. To get to this curve, this actually came up last night. There was a student there. He had just graduated, just got his master's degree in electrical engineering. He was one of the discussion table leaders. He's leading a Christian group outside of Caltech. He's also working with the Caltech graduate student Christian fellowship. But he waited till everybody was gone. This was took place at about 10 o'clock last night. The event started at 5:30. So yeah, people were just asking questions late into the night. But he waited till everybody was gone and said, "I have to talk to you." He said, "I was raised in a Christian home. I was raised as a young earth creationist. My mother is still a young earth creationist. My dad is a famous physicist. And because of this young earth issue, he left the church, stopped fellowshipping with other Christians. He still believes in God, but wants nothing to do with church and wants nothing to do with Christians." And he says, "How do I help him?" And I said, "Well, I think one way you can help him is basically encourage him that this young earth, old earth split in the church is nothing like it was 30 years ago, because it was 30 years ago he basically walked away from the church. And said, things are actually moving in a good direction." But I said, expose him to some church history, because what you'll notice over the past 2,000 years, there's always been a church splitting issue that has nothing to do with salvation. And he says, "Well, why?" I says, "Well, notice that Paul writes in his letters, we do not wrestle with flesh and blood. There are spiritual forces there working to divide the church." He says, "How else do you explain the way people in the church fight one another over things that got nothing to do with salvation?" And he says, "You can see it in the book of Acts, chapter 15. The church was split over circumcision. Circumcision's got nothing to do with salvation, but they wanted to kill the Apostle Paul because he believed that circumcision wasn't essential for salvation. And he wasn't the only one that was being targeted." I said, "That's the result of supernatural powers at work to try to destroy the Christian community and the Christian faith." And I says, "It's going to continue." And I says, "You can tell your father this, a time will come when the young earth, old earth issue no longer is splitting the church. And when that happens, God's going to replace that church splitting controversy by allowing the evil one to come up with another one." So he says, "Well, why does God do that? Why does God allow Satan to always throw out these church splitting controversies?" And he says, "Because of what we see in 2 Corinthians 5:18-20. There we have our commission. It says that we who are followers of Jesus Christ are ambassadors for peace. And we're ambassadors called to bring non-Christians to peace with Jesus Christ. That's our role, to bring unbelieving people to faith in Jesus Christ. But the reason why God allows these church-splitting controversies to persist as long as they do, and when they get resolved, why new ones keep popping up, is that non-Christians watch how we deal with our internal conflicts. And they can see us dealing with their internal conflicts in a gracious, charitable way, the non-Christians are going to trust us. But if they see us being vicious with respect to one another, they're going to say, I want nothing to do with these people. And I said, that's exactly what's happened to your dad. He has seen how Christians have behaved towards one another and says, I want nothing to do with this. And says it's blunted his own relationship with Jesus Christ, and it's stopping him from being a witness. And it's also affecting his own marriage, because his own wife is still in the young earth creationist camp. And he says, well, I see all this in my family. What can I do? And he says, well, let him know that progress is happening. And he says, what I'd like to do, he says, my dad lives in Portland. He told me the only Christian he'd ever want to talk to would be you. Okay. Next time he's down in the area, can we meet and have lunch? And I said, yeah, we'll do that. And I says, but also, what you can do in the meantime is just gently communicate to your father, not about the science, but about the Bible. If he can see how strongly the Bible teaches an old earth creationist perspective, says that might be the fastest way for him to be able to rejoin the Christian community. Because I think the problem is, he's dealing with his wife and says, the Bible says X, and he says, yeah, but I know physics says this, says the opposite. If he can see how physics and the Bible are basically saying the same thing, then he's going to be able to join the Christian community, he's going to be able to repair his marriage, and it's also going to be able to repair his relationship with you. That was probably the most significant thing that happened last night, because here is this young man who had no hope, and now he's got hope. So anyway, I encourage you to pray for him and for his dad and his mom. And
what's his name?
I never got his name, but he got my card. So, you know, people always ask me that. They say, Hugh, who was this person? I says, you know, when you're talking to 100 people over the course of a few hours, I get the faces, but I don't get the names. So, in fact, what was interesting, maybe it's just me, because I remember I used to sign all the donor receipts for the Reasons to Believe ministry, and I would meet people, I wouldn't know their name, but I'd know their address. So, so I stopped signing those receipts because it intimidated people. It's like, you know where I live, but you don't know my name. So, but hey, I'm a Caltech guy, so what do you expect? So. That's the way we are. You know, people asked me last night, you know, that show on TV, The Big Bang Theory, yeah. It doesn't really accurately portray all of us at Caltech. We're way nerdier than what they show us in that in that TV series. So, but I got an article coming out on our website, a blog piece, basically alerting you to the fact that there is a movement within the atheist scientific community, as well as the young earth creationist community, to deny that we live in an expanding universe. And it's our discovery that we live in an expanding universe which actually proved the universe has a beginning. As we pushed that, it actually proved that there must be a creator beyond space and time that created everything. And yet we have this enigma of Christians denying the Big Bang. And we have the atheists. So we have these Christians and atheists joined together as allies against Big Bang cosmology. And what I'm seeing in the literature, this just came out these past few weeks, is we've got Christians and we've got atheists both saying the redshifts have nothing to do with the expansion of the universe. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with that term. The best way I can describe it is think of a train that goes by you on the tracks and it blows its whistle. As it blows its whistle, as the train approaches, you hear a high pitch. And as it goes away, you hear a low pitch. I assume all of you have had that experience. The reason why you get a high pitch as the train is approaching you is the sound waves, because the train is moving towards you, those sound waves get bunched up. and so you get a high frequency. And as the train leaves you, the sound waves are stretched out, so you get a low pitch. Same thing happens to light. When a galaxy moves away from us, the wavelengths coming out of that wavelength, out of that galaxy get stretched out. And that's what they call the redshift. It means that blue light gets stretched into red light because of the stretching out of the wavelengths. So that's what redshift is. But there are people who are claiming that those redshifts are not a marker of the movement of stars and galaxies away from us. And so I've been compelled to write an article to refute that by basically making the point, the fundamental error is that they're thinking that the only way we have of showing that the universe is expanding is redshifts. In fact, we've got several tools that tell us the universe is expanding, and those alternate tools calibrate the redshift and tell us those redshift velocities or those redshift measurements actually accurately tell us how fast the stars and galaxies are moving away from us. So that's why I got this graph up here. This graph shows the cooling of the cosmic background radiation with respect to time. And these red dots are actual measurements of that. And this is the most accurate one that's been done. It's just been published, as you can see, back in 2013. The error bar on that measurement is so tiny, it's thinner than the thickness of that line by quite a good margin. Yes?
Can you kind of translate that graph into layman's terms?
Yeah, I could.
A little bit, please.
Okay. This is the present moment, and this takes you back to the beginning of time. So the era of time is going backwards. It's billions of years after the cosmic creation event. And what you have here is how warm that cosmic background radiation is. And you say, well, how are they actually able to get these measurements? There's a certain carbon spectral line that we see in galaxies, and the strength of that line is dependent on the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. So by looking at these carbon lines in distant galaxies, they can actually determine the temperature of the cosmic background radiation when the light left that galaxy. And so as we look at it today, as you heard Steve point out, right now that temperature is 2.75 degrees above absolute zero. But as you look at more distant galaxies, it goes up to 5, 10, and you know, close to 15 degrees. And as you plot that curve all the way through it, if you take it back to the beginning, the temperature is infinite.
So there's a cooling off going on?
Yes, there's a cooling off going on. Okay. Now, I was sharing with this young man that one way he might be able to reach out to both his mother and his father is to say, it's not just measurements like this. The Bible tells us. You've got verses in the Bible that tell us the universe has a beginning, an actual beginning of space and time itself. 11 passages tell us the universe expands from that beginning. It expands under laws of physics that do not change. And one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. So I'm going to remind you of what you learned when you were in high school physics. Okay? Some of you are probably saying, high school physics? What's that? Junior high physics. Okay. Namely, that any system that expands gets colder. For example, that's how your car engine works. There's a piston chamber. And when the piston chamber expands, the gasoline stops burning. When the piston chamber compresses, the gasoline reignites. And that's simply because of the fact that as you take a volume of air and you compress it, the temperature goes up. Have you ever pumped a bicycle tire? When you pump a bicycle tire, you know that the pump gets warm. And it's because you're pushing air and squeezing into a smaller volume. That principle applies to everything in the universe. It applies to the universe itself. And so one reason why we know the universe must be expanding is because of this temperature curve. Okay, because we look back in time, we see the universe was warmer.
And they measure that through different instruments, right?
Well, they use similar instruments, but they're using it on different galaxies. Galaxies at different distances. So for example, we're looking here at a galaxy that's 12 billion light years away. And there you're measuring the temperature of the cosmic background radiation 12 billion years ago. And so that's what astronomers do, is they look at distant galaxies and are able to get a measure of the cosmic background radiation at these different points. They're able to plot a curve through it. And the curve that they plot through, given that you know that the age of the universe is 13.8 billion years, is exactly what you'd expect, given what the Bible says about the expansion of the universe, the beginning of space and time, the constancy of physics, and the pervasiveness of the law of decay. So that is a biblically predicted cooling curve. And the fact is, we got actual measurements showing us that's exactly what the universe looks like. Or in terms of helping the mother of this young man, you only get this shape if the universe is 13.8 billion years old. If the universe were only thousands of years old, you would not get that shape, or you wouldn't get those temperature measurements. Yes?
To help with witnessing better, I've taken it by myself without cross-referencing in the Bible where it says God bowed the heavens to mean partly this, largely this. Would I be correct? Could you expound a bit?
What was the text?
The word bowed, he bowed.
Oh, you're using the word, not bowed, but like a bow and arrow.
To stretch a bow.
Right. Yeah, you could use that text. But there's actually explicit text that refers to how God stretches out the heavens. There's 11 texts that use that phrase. The Hebrew verb is the verb natah, and it literally means the expansion of what's being described. Now, you can go to reasons.org and just put these into the search engine Big Bang. It will pop up an article that says Big Bang, the Bible said it first. And that will actually give you all the texts. In that article, I give you all the passages. And with the help of a Hebrew scholar, I show you what all those words mean. And basically, it does make the point that thousands of years before any astronomer had a hint that we live in an expanding universe, the Bible is already declaring that, in fact, we do. And it's not just me looking at the text with hindsight. Jewish theologians living centuries ago saw the same thing. So Big Bang cosmology actually goes back way before Edwin Hubble and Albert Einstein. The Bible said it first. In fact, I can tell you that was a major factor in my coming to Christ, was recognizing the Bible had predicted these statements hundreds of years before any scientists discovered that they were in fact correct.
And you got that just from reading the text? You didn't read
Got that from reading the text. Right, yeah. Well, I mean, the first hint that you get in the scientific community that we live in an expanding universe was not until 1925. So for thousands of years before that, the Bible was saying that we live in an expanding universe. Moreover, it's the only holy text that made that statement. You won't find that in the Hindu Vedas or the Quran or any other book that's the basis of a major religion. It's unique to the Bible.
So you read that before 1925, right, when you were a young man?
I'm not that old. Okay.
Sorry.
John. Well, what you'll see in the astrophysical literature is the beginning of the universe is an infinitely or near infinitely shrunken volume.
Near infinitely.
Yeah, 9 dimensions. Now, what our measurements tell us, it could be either way. It could be truly infinite or it could be nearly infinite.
Well,
our measurements can't tell the difference. Well, if indeed the volume is shrunken to an infinite degree, the temperature would be infinity. But if it's near infinite, it's near infinity. And the problem is our measurements only take us back to 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the cosmic creation event. So what we know is, yeah, the universe began in extremely small size. And it all depends how God brings space and time into existence. We don't know. He could have done it in such a way that it actually begins with a literally infinite, infinitely small volume, or he could have began it with something that was near infinitely small. Both options are open to God, and both options are permitted by the measurements we have. And so it's an open philosophical question. Well, this is for another discussion, but there's actually value of the term infinity in physics. And if you've ever taken calculus, you realize that infinity is something that's a very useful tool. Right, okay.
Yeah, I view this is really important, obviously, is this, the argument that John's brought up is obviously where the atheists go. So the atheists that tell me or non-believers that tell me, you know, that we really don't know the universe had a beginning, they're going to this fraction of a second after the universe began, saying because we don't know exactly what happened, you know, that 0.00, you know, part right after the creation of the universe, because we don't know that, that means they're really kind of throw out the whole Big Bang theory.
Right.
So it's important what John's bringing up is that
right.
If you hear atheists going to there and trying to confuse you with that, that's the ridiculousness of it, obviously. And I say that we have recorded, you know, history of the universe for 13, 8 billion years old, and you're going to tell me you're not going to trust the creator because you don't know what happened that fraction of a second. And since you don't live your life that way, and it's absurd to go to that point to try and argue that there is no beginning.
Well, if any of you want help with this, there's an article I have on our reasons.org website titled Responding to Non-Empirical Arguments That Atheists Give for the Non-Existence of God. And I basically make the point that if you're going to appeal to the unknown, you can disprove anything.
Right.
And so one example I give in the article is how I could appeal to the unknown and actually demonstrate that my wife doesn't exist. Okay, that can be done. And it can be done with anything. And the whole point is what you're suggesting, pointing out the philosophical inconsistency of using that approach. I mean, if you're going to use that as your philosophical standard of living, then actually nothing exists. I can't even prove my own existence. So, you know, maybe we're all in a hologram kind of thing. So maybe the Christian scientists are right. There is no such thing as physical reality. And what alarmed me is when I was at the Evangelical Theological Society, there were actually theologians there who had a four-hour session promoting the idea that physical reality is not real. And that, you know, we live in an idealistic universe where the only things that are real are our minds and our thoughts. And the only way that we have physical reality is if we think about these physical real things. And they said, you know, the only barrier we have to promoting this new philosophy are scientists. So I was the only scientist in the audience, and I would say, you know, good luck with that. Well, yeah, what I was trying to explain to these theologians is we astronomers actually have measurements, direct measurements, that show us the actual distances to these objects. And they said, well, that's you astronomers thinking about it. And I said, no, the instrument is doing it. It's not just me, the astronomer. The instrument is actually establishing that this thing is real. It's got a particular distance. They kept insisting, well, it's inferred. You're making assumptions. And so I had to show them how triangulation trigonometry establishes the reality of these objects.
You show them proof and they say, prove it, prove it, prove it. That's
well, what I realized, they had forgotten all their grade 11 mathematics. So I had to kind of give them a quick lesson on plane geometry that we all learned in high school. I mean, I still think it's true. Nobody can graduate from high school without being exposed to the elementary Greek theorems of plane geometry. And that's really all we need to establish that there really is a physical world out there, independent of our mind. But yeah, I was alarmed that this is actually invading the evangelical Christian community at the level of PhD seminarians. So we live in really remarkable times. So remarkable, I've only got 5 minutes to get us into Ecclesiastes 7 and 8. And what I'm going to do here is that, you know, as we've been mentioning, for the first six chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes, we have Solomon here explaining the consequences of an existential philosophy. But if you actually read the entire book of Ecclesiastes, it's basically a primer on how can we reach existentialists for Christ. And so there's an, as I mentioned before, there's an important transition from chapter 6 to chapter 7. Because in the first six chapters, there's really no mention, direct mention of God. It's implied, but it's not mentioned. Once you get into chapter 7, he begins to get explicit. However, what you're going to notice as you go from chapter 7 to chapter 12 is that it's graduated. What Solomon is doing, basically what you have starting in chapter 7 is a bunch of proverbs. And there's a few comments interspersed between the proverbs, but it's essentially proverbs. And the whole point is, okay, if you're an existentialist, proverbs have no purpose at all. I mean, why live your life in a gracious, humble, wise way if there is no God and the only thing is our existence? And so he basically throws out all these proverbs, basically appealing to the existentialist. He says, you know, I'm an existentialist, but I can't deny that there's wisdom behind these proverbs, and this is a good way to live. Well, why is it a good way to live? If there is no God, it makes no sense that this would be a good way to live, or that you could even say there is a good way to live. But he throws this out, and what you notice as you go through the proverbs, he begins to sprinkle in God. But he does it in a very gradual way. And it reaches a crescendo at the close of the end of chapter 12. And as you get to the very last paragraph of chapter 12, Solomon lays it all out. The only meaning we can derive from life is if we base our life on God and submit our life to God. So he kind of gives you the gospel closer at the very end. But the whole point that he's making in the book of Ecclesiastes, it's challenging to bring existentialists to faith in Jesus Christ. And you need to use a particular approach to have any success with these people. And they're one of the most difficult people of all to reach for Christ. But here he's giving us a prescription on how you can have an effective outreach to existentialists. So that's where we're going to go next week, is basically begin. And we already started in chapter 7, where we talked about why it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a wedding, because the funeral really expresses upon you the inevitable. You're going to die.
And we established that the same thing too, right? Marriage and death.
Well, you're in trouble. You better get some of that jewelry that my friend Mick Peters was talking about. So, but you are making a point in one sense. I love to do marriages, I love to do funerals, because in both cases, you have an incredible opportunity to lay out the gospel to people who are not yet believers. So marriage is a great tool for communicating the Christian faith, and so are funerals. But funerals, as it says here, are more critical in the sense we're all going to die, and we all need to think about death, and how often the existentialist lives his or her life never thinking about death, and also never thinking about the fact that there's something written on our heart that tells us there is life after death. I mean, that's in Ecclesiastes 3:11. Eternity is written upon our hearts. What we see in John 16, every human being knows that judgment's coming. We run away from it, but it's written on our hearts that judgment comes after we die. And one way you can reach out to an existentialist is simply point out to them, notice how different it is for a human being to die than a dog or a cat to die. They face death in very different ways. We fear death because of the judgment that will follow if you're an unbeliever. And that's what you notice. That's something you can bring out with existentialists. As you talk to them the right way, you can expose that fear they have of what's going to happen to them when this life is over. It's not so much that they say, well, I'm just going to cease to exist. Well, if you're going to cease to exist, then why are you reacting with such extreme emotion to the coming of your death? The rationale is we know there's life after death. Everybody knows that. And what we have here in Ecclesiastes is a prescription for how do you expose that in a gentle enough way, in a gradual enough way, that the existentialist receives it and comes to their senses. So next week, we'll do that. And let me pray. And Father in heaven, first of all, we want to thank you for the opportunity we have this evening to celebrate your incarnation, the fact that you, the creator of the universe, took it upon yourself to become one of us, to become a human being, and yet to retain your divinity so that you can deliver us from the consequences of spiritual death. We thank you, Lord, for the gift of physical death. Thank you, Lord, how are you using that to deliver us from spiritual death so we can spend eternity with you and with one another, enjoying a depth of fellowship. But Lord, we thank you for the opportunity tonight to have a little taste of what you promised to give us in the new creation for the rest of eternity. And Father, I pray that as we move towards the celebration of your actual birth, that Lord, you give us many opportunities to reach out to friends and relatives that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior, that this Christmas season they may come into a relationship with you, the creator of the universe. In Jesus' name, amen.